You're listening to the Expression Engine Podcast, episode number 67, with special guest Leslie Camacho here to talk about remote teams. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is sponsored by Engine Summit. The online live Engine Summit covers the ins and outs of Expression Engine without the travel hassle of a traditional conference. It's like bringing the experts to your desktop. At the end of the Engine Summit, it's the popular Ellis Lab roundtable discussion hosted by our guest today, CEO of Ellis Lab, Leslie Camacho, talking about the state of EE and answering your questions. Sign up today and save 20% when using the discount code EEPodcast at enginesummit.com.
The Expression Engine Podcast would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor of the year. Hi, Leah. How's life treating you these days?
Pretty good. I'm always excited to have someone from Ellis Lab on the show.
Me too. And we haven't had a guest on the show in a few episodes, so today will be a nice change of pace. Since we're going to be talking about remote teams today, I was curious, do you consider yourself a remote worker as a freelancer?
You know, when I was thinking about this topic, I didn't really think it applied to me directly since I'm a solo business. I do work remotely with people around the world, but not necessarily in a team environment or specific regular basis. Then I realized, this podcast.
Right.
You and I are a distributed team that have to collaborate and work on a regular basis. Sometimes I think when we work online, it's easy to forget we're in completely different cities, let alone countries. Though I think being in the same time zone helps.
Yeah, that's true. I actually didn't even think that how we manage the podcast. But yeah, we are a remote team. When I was thinking about the topic, I immediately connected with the remote worker title because I've been working remotely from my home office for about 8 years now. And six of those years were for my former employer. And then now, of course, I'm working for myself. And I love working remotely. I have those, you know, the oatmeal comic moments when I realize I haven't showered in a couple days or I haven't spoken to another human being. But I'm an independent worker and I hated the distractions of working in an office. So I can't imagine working any differently.
Totally agree. I do consider myself a remote worker too, because even with local clients, I work from home as well. And I only do the occasional meeting, which usually happens during the sales process or the final handoff or training. So sometimes it might as well be in another country. But working remotely as a freelancer or independent worker is totally different from remotely working with a virtual team.
Exactly. And that's why we're talking with Leslie Camacho today, to get the bigger picture perspective on remote working. Les is the chief executive officer of Ellis Lab, and he's been with the company for 9 years, CEO since late 2010. He's also one of the nicest people you will ever meet. And today he's going to talk to us about how he's running Ellis Lab as a virtual company and leading a team of almost 16 full-time people remotely. Welcome, Leslie.
Hey, good morning, guys.
How are you doing?
You know, I'm not doing bad. It started out as one of those oatmeal days for me as well. So
nice.
My kid got me up at 4:45 a.m. And so I'm already, it's 9 a.m. where I am, and I'm already on hour 5 of being awake, 2 cups of coffee. So it's that kind of day.
crazy.
So, you know, when we were talking with Lisa West, oh gosh, I can't even remember which episode number it was, but she was talking a lot about how you guys manage the communications with everyone working distributedly. What made you guys kind of, I mean, was it just the inherent nature of how Ellis Lab was from the beginning to be sort of a virtual company with remote workers, or was this a focused goal that you guys have been striving for?
It was definitely just the nature of how Ellis Lab started. We never had the intention of growing the company remotely, but since that's how it started, that's how it naturally grew as well. It pretty much started with Rick, because Rick is sort of, he's a wanderer, so he moves a lot on purpose. And so when he started Ellis Lab, he was in Los Angeles, and then they moved to Bend, Oregon. And then later on to Hawaii and Florida. And so he jumps around a lot. And I've done the same thing. I started out in Southern California, went to Lincoln, Nebraska, up to Oregon, then back to California. Now I'm back in Oregon again.
And that's just been in the time you've been with Ellis Lab?
Yeah, that's just been in the time you've been with Ellis Lab. And that's not true of everyone at the company, but there was never a once we had it started as a remote company, there's a certain lifestyle aspect to it that we really enjoyed. And so we never made any real attempt to consolidate. We always talked about maybe we'll move to the same location, but it never really panned out that way. That said, Derek Jones, who's our CTO, is moving to Bend, Oregon, where I live, in a couple weeks. So I'm excited about having him in the same town as me. So I'll get to see what the other side of the coin is like, at least for a while.
Nice. So you sort of mentioned that the way you guys started type of quality of life came with it. I know personally when I talk to other people about the fact that I've worked remotely for such a long time, they immediately think, oh, that just must be great. You probably can do whatever you want, work on your own schedule. And that all is true, but there are challenges. Are they even compounded when you're dealing with so many people on staff? And what kind of challenges are you dealing with?
Yeah, all the pros of working remotely are also all the cons of working remotely as well. Mm-hmm. With a few other ones. So you can set your own schedule, but that means you have to set your own schedule.
Right. Yeah. You have to be responsible.
Exactly. It's like, hey, look, I just watched 3 episodes of Survivor. Maybe I should have actually done some work. You know, you can fall into that trap so much more easily when you work remotely. And so then when you're actually running a distributed company, then you run into things like, well, how do I structure the company? You know, how do I get people to report their hours? Do I even need to worry about that? Because when you start individually, when it was just Rick and I and Paul and it was just the 3 of us, it was really easy because you just had 3 people that knew exactly what they were supposed to do at all times. And so that's when it was actually easiest, when it was just 3 people, because you didn't really need any structure. You just needed a commitment to email. And so we would go months without actually talking to each other, even on the phone, and Skype didn't really exist back in those days. And so when we went from 3 people to 6 people, that's when we really started feeling the challenges, because you have a compounded challenge that anytime you grow a company, you already have your own set of growing pains built in with doing that. And then when it's distributed, what happens is that the advice, especially, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, there was almost no business advice that translated directly to what we were trying to do. And so that just made it made everything seem harder than it actually was. But at the same time, the rewards of doing that were also worth it. And so 9 years into it, we're beginning to feel like we've done something that's a little bit uncommon, and we just wanted to share more of what we've done, especially our mistakes and successes. But the big challenge is, you know, how do you even do it when nothing actually translates in the way that you think it should?
You know, that actually makes me curious, because you said the real challenges hit you guys when you doubled. You went from 3 to 6. Those 3 new people you brought on board, did you have any way of assessing whether they could work in a virtual environment, whether they were a good fit to add to this sort of company that really there wasn't a precedent for you to be referencing?
We thought we did. And to some extent, we were right. But it's one of those things where you're doing something brand new to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so you have nobody at the company that's a trained business person. I'm the closest. I actually have a degree in marketing management or something like that, back in the 90s when marketing meant being on a shelf, not being on the web. So I, you know, but at least there was a business degree there. But Rick's a sound engineer, and no one else at the company had formal training. So we were winging it on our own for a long time. And I think in our industry, what happens a lot is you have people that are so absolutely competent at producing and making things that there is this built-in ego that takes place I see it most closely in my doctor friends. Because they're good doctors, they think they're also good at computers or good at setting up stereo systems. And so on the web, man, I'm really good at HTML and CSS, so I must be really good at structuring a company. You know, if you say it out loud, it sounds so ridiculous. But when you're in the thick of it, you don't even really think about it. And so you have that natural growing pain where you have to really expand your skill set and you have to be humble, but your success leads you to not be humble and you don't even realize it. So you end up making a lot of mistakes just accidentally, not even know you're doing it. So when we went from 3 to 6 people, it was actually going from 4 to 8 that was the more challenging, if I want to be specific to us, but doubling in size from 4 to 8, because it just exposed every single thing we were doing wrong in terms of how we worked together, and then trying to figure that out remotely. So we would read a business book or get business advice. I had business mentors and they would say, you know, have you tried this technique or that technique? And I'd go home and be really excited about implementing it. And then we would sit down and I would think, well, I can't actually do this because these 8 people aren't in the same room right. with me ever. And so then that says, well, then what's actually the theme or the spirit of this advice? And then how do we translate that into a distributed environment? And that turned out to be really challenging. Sometimes it would be easier, sometimes harder. But for the most part, it was harder simply because there wasn't a template that we could follow.
Mm-hmm. So without that type of template, what were the steps you took to finally make that template, to finally make that structure?
I think the saving grace for us in terms of figuring out was we had 2 epiphanies as a company, and then 1 thing that we always did right that turned out to be a lifesaver for us. The first one is, I forget which South By it was, but we were at South By, and I just overheard someone talking about Scrum and what Scrum was. And I ended up talking with him for, I think, almost 3.5 hours. And so when we discovered that, we had a structure then that we could implement internally that was more than just what internally we call our previous way of working, a cowboy or artist style, that was really just haphazard. Mm-hmm. It resembled more of a room full of freelancers doing their own stuff mm-hmm. than a team working towards a specific goal. So when we discovered Scrum, that makes it sound like we invented it. When someone introduced us to Scrum and we implemented it, we had a structure then, and just having a structure, any structure at all, solved a lot of our problems just by default. And I know there's always, you know, Scrum is one of those things that people always have love-hate relationships with it, and we're no different in that sense. But I think the important thing wasn't Scrum itself, but that we had something concrete that we could all sort of embrace as a starting point for how we work together. So why this was good from just a very practical level is simply that we now had a training method. So when we hired a developer, we could say, this is how we work, and you could train them into that. This is when we communicate, so make sure you do that. This is what's expected of you every 2 weeks, and we had a system for doing that. So I don't think it was necessarily Scrum itself, but just having that ability to train it out. And where Scrum did lend itself well than other things is that Scrum has 2 aspects to it that really solved problems we didn't even know we had. And one of them was Scrum doesn't worry about tracking time in the traditional sense. So I don't worry about how many hours someone works mm-hmm. in a day. I only worry about how many hours are left to have something completed. So that took care of the time tracking problem for us in a very large sense. And the other thing was that it solved the communication problem, because the one thing that we always did right was communicate. Mm-hmm. Internally, we've always had a commitment to making sure we're talking to each other, and Lisa's especially good about keeping us honest about this. So if someone's not talking to someone else, then we know about it. And we really had to reaffirm that commitment around 8 people, because when we went from 4 to 8, that got so chaotic. It, you know, you would get 100 emails a day just generated from these 8 people. Wow. And so if you have a structure, that solves a lot, that reduces the email volume without reducing the communication.
You mentioned that Scrum kind of pointed out these 2 things you didn't know you had a problem with, that first one being the time tracking. So if you're not tracking time in a traditional sense, what are you doing? Are you, I guess it sounds like you're tracking what's estimated to complete a given task?
Yes, very much so. So the very basics of how Scrum works is that you'll say like feature X will take 40 hours to complete, and it's a pure guess. And what Scrum does really well is that it doesn't matter whether those 40 hours are 40 actual hours because it uses a relative measuring system. We could do a whole podcast about that, but for right now, let's just accept that the 40 hours don't necessarily have to translate into real hours. It's just a number that you measure your progress against. Mm-hmm. And so then as the person in charge of the company, at the end of the day, I don't really care if my dev team has spent 2 hours working or 12 hours working. What I care is, did the total number of hours drop? Did it go from 40 to 35 to 30? And you track that over, you know, 2 or 3 week time periods. And so over time, I can see then that my team is making progress towards this goal, or we're going to ship late, or we're going to ship early, and then have some downtime or some time to do a side project or something like that. So over the course of a year, you can look back and say, you know, those 40 hours, relatively speaking, you know, were fairly accurate, or we weren't accurate, so we need to adjust. So that's what I mean, where it doesn't really matter what your schedule like or whether you're reporting hours during the day, because it's impossible to hide, because every 2 weeks, was the work done or was it not done? Mm-hmm. If it's not done, then why? And since Scrum forces the communication and is centered around shipping, if you're not working, it's going to be really obvious. Mm-hmm. So time tracking becomes inconsequential.
Mm-hmm. So what about that communication part? How does Scrum help you manage that more effectively?
Scrum helped us manage that more effectively by doing several things. The most important thing for me as the person as the CEO of the company and responsible for making sure the direction is correctly, is heading where I think it should be heading. It helps me insert myself into their daily lives in a way that is non-disruptive to them. Scrum basically says that every 2 weeks, that's the most appropriate time for me to step in and say, this is going well, this is not going well, versus if I'm looking in a Git repo or I see an email or I hear a report, hey, is this not going well? And then suddenly I pull the dev team out and I'm talking to them and now they're distracted and then they've lost 2 days of development
time. It's disruptive.
Right. You know, so in the past, for example, when it was just three of us, if I saw something that Rick was working on that I had questions about, I would write him, you know, a small book, and then he write a small book back, and then I'd respond with a small book. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and over time, you'd have these series of emails, thousands of words long, mm-hmm. and they were happening every single day, which is fine if it's two people, because that's not actually as disruptive. Mm-hmm. But if you've got 8 people and then 16 people, you just can't write 16 small books in a day. And then if you do, then you've disrupted 16 people instead of just one, and you've actually slowed down production significantly. Mm-hmm. And so what Scrum does is it says, as the CEO, or as the Scrum uses the term stakeholder. So if you have a stake in the outcome of a feature set or a support renovation or something like that, then at the 2 week review, that's when you give that small book input and you give it in real time so that you can have those discussions back and forth. So now instead of writing, when I see something I don't like or something I do like that I want to replicate, I'll take notes to myself and just tag it for the next sprint review and say, because that has everyone at the company present and you can just take care of a lot of that in real time. So for me, as the person running the shop, that makes it much, much easier. And then I'm out of their hair. I'm not micromanaging. They're free to do what they do best.
So I just want to focus on the nitty gritty specifics about the communication. So you mentioned emails, and then how Scrum helped reduce the amount of emails simply because there is better structure and better communication. However, with 16 team members full time, I don't necessarily, this may be my assumption, wondering if email is the best form of communication to get your points across and to get the communication to happen. What kind of tools does your team use in order to effectively communicate to each other?
That's an excellent question. And Lisa West is actually working up an article for the Ellis Lab blog that will go into a little bit of detail about what we're doing that. And I think that's going up this week. But basically, it starts with the structure. And so the tools that you use should be reflective of the structure that you have. So the counterpoint to the two-week, or not the counter, but the other side of the two-week reviews that we use is that we have daily stand-ups. And these are real-time, in-person meetings with that are per team. So they're not company-wide. So the dev team will have a stand-up. The support team will have a stand-up. The executive team has a stand-up. And these stand-ups are limited to 15 minutes. And you're just answering three questions. What did I do yesterday? What am I doing today? And are there any obstacles or things in my way? And you just talk those out really quickly between the people on your team, and that sort of sets the context for all the rest of the communication for the rest of the day.
Is this in a video conference? Is that how it's face-to-face?
No, we don't actually do video conferencing that often. I would like to, but the big problem with video conferencing is that once you get more than two or three people, inevitably someone doesn't have the bandwidth to support that. Where I am, I'm limited to 5 meg upload speed, which I hate significantly. And then you have someone, you know, like my friend Aaron, who lives in Chattanooga, that they got full on fiber and they got some ridiculous 100 up, 100 down speeds.
Wow.
And then you have someone that might be on the road and they're calling in from 3G. So video conferencing becomes a big challenge. So for the standups, we use a Mac software program called Sococo. And it's sort of like a virtual office setting. And the program itself isn't really that great. But what it does is it creates this sort of video game style space. And I use that term very loosely. And so you can all see yourselves around a conference table, for example, with little icons, sort of like a really simplified version of Second Life or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it does two things well. It makes it easy to do large, get everyone in the same room talking in real time, and it makes screen sharing really easy. So that's how we handle the stand-ups on a regular basis, is using that.
And is that what you also use for the two-week reviews?
For the two-week reviews, we use GoToMeeting. And the reason we use GoToMeeting is that Sococo works really well if you have less than 8 people. But once you get over 8 people, Sococo uses peer-to-peer connections. And so, again, if there's a weak link in the bandwidth chain, then the whole thing falls apart. And GoToMeeting doesn't do that. So with GoToMeeting, it's easy to get 16 people in there. And if we do any video conferencing, it's usually in GoToMeeting where 3 or 4 of us will turn our cameras on and just goof off, you know, for the being of the meeting. So, yeah, for the two-week meetings, we use GoToMeeting. It turned out to be the best way for us to do that. And for the daily stand-ups, it's Sococo. And then the rest of the day is a combination of email and IM. And for IM, we use a program called HipChat. But just about any IM tool out there will do the trick.
You still mentioned email. You don't use any project management system like Basecamp at all?
Yes, we do. So there's so if you'll notice, there's when you run a distributed company, there's a whole set of tools that you have to use, and these are all. Oh man, this term makes me sound old. But we MacGyver it. You know, that's one of the things. Distributed. There is no single package for distributed teams that will meet all these needs. So for project management, the dev team will use a program called Pivotal Tracker. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like Basecamp for Scrum. It's really easy to set up projects in a Scrum style format that's fairly simplified and that everyone can see and share. And then we also use Basecamp internally as well. So one of the things we discovered about Scrum is that it's really good for teams that are working on specific projects. But Scrum really doesn't translate that well if your job is reactionary or has to be changed on a regular basis. So for the support team, for example, tried running the support team in Scrum for a while, and that just didn't work because their job changes, you know, every 10 minutes, it seems. And so they needed a different set of tools and way of working for them. So we use Basecamp for a lot of internal projects as well as when we work with third parties. And mostly we chose Basecamp for third parties because everyone knows Basecamp at this point. So if you're inviting someone into Basecamp, there's a good familiarity with the tool set already.
For these, the daily stand-ups and the two-week reviews, are they scheduled and they're the same time every day or every week?
Yes, all that is set in advance. And that is critical because we're across, I think, four time zones. And so once we found a time that everyone can meet, we lock that in.
Did that take forever?
It does. that's really between Lisa and Wes Baker. The two of them work really hard to make sure that we are, you know, can schedule those company-wide meetings. So we actually have one today. That's my next meeting today. I have it. It starts at 11 a.m. Pacific my time, and it'll go for – usually it goes about 2 hours. But that's everyone together. And the daily stand-ups are also scheduled per team. So each team determines its own stand-up. Time whenever it's convenient for them to meet.
So is there like a structured way you deal with time zones, or is everyone just meant to understand what zone they're in and what zone you're in and what zone somebody else is in?
Yes, it's more the second. The only the support team is really the only team that has to worry about time zones on a consistent basis. And that's because they have to make sure that all our support hours are covered. We've really changed support a ton in the last year, and we're going to change it again a ton this year. But the basic premise is that the support team has to cover business hours in Pacific time. And so then they have to arrange their schedules according to that. And sometimes that can take some doing, but typically it's not too much of a problem.
We've talked a little bit about the specifics of the tools you're using for communication. I'm just curious, it sounds like having the structure in place is sort of the essential part of it, but how long did it take for everyone to sort of fall into this and work like a team, everyone following these new structures? Or is it still something you're working out, evaluating, and fine-tuning?
So here's the thing about structure and communication. Every solution eventually becomes its own problem. And that is just something – I think this is true of non-distributed teams as well. But like, for example, we were so in love with Scrum for about a year, and then we started having problems because of Scrum. And so communication is the same way. You communicate a certain way over a certain time period because you're solving a previous problem. But inevitably, the solutions you bring in create its own set of problems. So with both structure and communication, it's really important that you review how it's going on a consistent basis so that you can figure out if it's still working for you, or it needs to evolve and change. Like just last week, Wes came to me and said, you know, the development team is not liking the way, you know, this part of how we work is going. Can we change it? And my answer is, yeah, absolutely. You have to. You know that much better than I do. And so they went and they made changes, and the support team does the same thing with Kevin, and the executive team does the same thing. What I stressed to my team at the beginning of this year that I really discovered after my first year of being CEO is that it's always important to be forward-thinking with communication and structure and adhere to a system, but you can't be married to it in the sense that you can't be rigid about its implementation. The only thing that you have to be consistent on is your commitment to each other. And so when you talk about have we always felt like a team, yes. Even when some parts were dysfunctional or this was happening, if your hiring process is right and you have a company culture that brings you together, then you can fail consistently and recover consistently because it's not the structure that makes the company and it's not the tools that you use to communicate that make the company, it's the people. And so it's your commitment to the people that you work with that gets you through any particular change. And we've been very fortunate in that regard.
Is there anything you guys do as a company to sort of keep that sense of commitment to each other and camaraderie going when you are distributed? I mean, that maybe isn't tied to your daily stand-ups or a project or a task, but just the essentials of who you are as people in the company.
There's no one single thing that we do, but lately we've been trying to do things for that more intentionally than we have in the past. There was a threshold that we passed when we went from somewhere along the time between going from 10 or 12 people to 16 people, that became something that we had to be more intentional about. It didn't exist that much when we had less than 12 employees, because it was still, I think when you have less than 12, it's still really easy to get to know people. Mm-hmm. Just as you go about your daily work life. But now with 16 people, we have to be a lot more intentional about getting to know people. So like specifically, it turns out that a lot of us like board games.
Nice.
Especially on the dev team and the executive team. So, you know, sometimes you can go into Sococo and you'll see Wes and James in the courtyard and they're playing an online game of some sort that's based off a board game. Or, you know, we'll sometimes play Ticket to Ride on the iPad together. Almost at every sprint review starts and ends with a discussion about a good board game, coffee, beer. But a lot of that is just an intentional reaching out to say, hey, how's your day going? You know, and that's why the daily stand-ups help so much, is because you get a sort of a feel for people's lives. Like so much about being a distributed company, it's easy and hard at the same time, because when you work remotely, there is such a strong confluence of what happens in your personal life and professional life that bleeds together, that I don't think happens in a physical office. So like, for example, when we report obstacles, I will actually say, my kid woke me up at 4 a.m. I've been working 5 hours already. That means this afternoon I'm going to be bummed. So please, if you have something critical, send it to me in the next couple hours, because I know this afternoon I'm going to be shot. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that you would, you know, I don't have a lot of experience working in a physical office, so maybe it's that way too. But we end up knowing a lot more about each other's personal lives than I think is more than typical, simply because of what you have to communicate, because you are working from home most of the time. And so we get to know each other in those ways. We know who's selling their house, who's moving, who's renting, who, you know, whatever problems may come up that I don't think would normally come up as part of work versus what might normally come up over, like if the three of us go out to lunch, we all work in the same office and we go out to lunch. I think we have those conversations, mm-hmm. but those conversations in a distributed team come up during the actual work versus time set aside for it.
That sort of blurring of the work life line, has it been a challenge to, you know, draw the line at when the end of the workday is, or, you know, making sure that, you know, for example, if you have kids at home, that they're not able to come into the office or your working space for a set number of time, you know, just sort of drawing a line from your personal perspective and then what you see your staff doing?
Yes. Working from home was a lot easier before I had kids. There's no...
Isn't everything easier?
Yes. That is true. That's a good point. For me, what happens is that the people who work best remotely and that you tend to hire tend to be workaholics. So the hardest part is just stopping work, especially when you work from a laptop. You know, 5 o'clock rolls around and you shut the laptop off and you go eat dinner, but then 7, you're like, oh man, maybe Derek emailed me back. So you pop it open, and now it's even worse with, you know, smartphones and tablets, and because you're playing Ticket to Ride, and then you think, oh, you know, well, I could just go check to see if, you know, Kevin got back to me on that draft. And so we had to make, I had to make a really conscious effort just to stop work at a certain time, unless I'd worked it out with my wife in advance. And for a number of years, I really avoided having a separate office. But when we were looking for a house most recently, we made a conscious decision to only get a house that had an office separate from the house. So we found a house that had a small garage, and so I converted the garage into a home office. And that's the first time I've actually worked out of the house, in a sense, consistently, and that's been very helpful, just to have a separate space where I'm still at home, but it's a lot easier to not have people wander in and disrupt my day. And it also makes it easier for me to leave work. So there's definitely a discipline that you have to get into, and you just have to acknowledge that you're not going to be able to separate them, and instead you have to find a way to make them work together. Mm-hmm. And probably a really good example of this is if I leave work stressed and I don't talk to my wife about it, then I carry that stress into the rest of my family. Mm. And so I will be physically present with my family, but mentally I'm still working out some issue or solving some problem, and that's not fair to them. So we actually have a routine that we go to. When I've stopped work, I talk about my day. I have to actually sit and engage. And sometimes she says, no, you just need to go play your Xbox for 40 minutes until you've left work behind, and then come upstairs and you'll be here. So you have to find that routine that's going to be specific to your significant other and your kids so that you can be fully present for them. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds like a lot of work, but there's also the pro to this. The pro to this is that every single hour, like yesterday, I really didn't want to work. I had this boatload of stuff, especially writing. I was having some writer's block, and it would have been easy to avoid that. But all I have to do is look out my office window, and I see my kids playing in the yard, and I say, oh, that's why I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, you need that reminder. And when you work at home, you know, assuming your home's life is good, of course, then it's a really simple snapback reminder. It's like, oh, yes, that's a huge reason for me to do this. Ultimately, this is the way I feed my family. And even if I love my job, and even if I love my community, and even if I love what I do professionally, there's always that greater need that I'm answering to. And being so close to that is a huge motivator. And so it sort of drowns out all the cons that go along with figuring out these details. And so what I try to do with Ellis Lab is I really try to communicate that so that after the honeymoon period is over for remote working, because there is a honeymoon period where it seems like the best thing ever, and then it where you have to have this reminder that we do this because there's something greater than ourselves that we're trying to accomplish. And so then I always tie that back. You know, it also means that everyone who uses Expression Engine or Code Igniter or Mojo Motor or is thinking about doing it, they all have families. They all need to put a roof over their heads. And what I'm doing right now impacts their ability to do that, just like it impacts my ability to do that. And as far as a cultural perspective at Ellis Lab, that is something that we drive home from the moment we hire. You know, we're a family-oriented company. We're a people-oriented company. And we take that aspect of being distributed really seriously in terms of reminding why it is that we go through all the pains to do this.
That is a lot of information for this podcast. Yeah. I do have a couple more questions before we end it, more business-related, practical stuff. Are there any legal considerations for a virtual company that you have to think about when you're hiring, when you're hiring within your own city? I'm sure you just deal with your municipal and state laws, but when people are in different time zones, is there anything that you need to consider?
Yes. This is and fortunately for me, Rick Ellis, the owner of Ellis Lab, has done a tremendous amount of work for years figuring that stuff out. So I will tell you just quickly the two most important things that you need to consider with a distributed team are the IRS and healthcare. Mm. So because we are really serious about being good to people and a family sort of setting company, that has to start with your employees, and that means that we have to have health care for our employees. And we
Yay.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't want to skimp on that. Now, the problem is that health care does not acknowledge the existence of distributed companies at all. Mm.
Yeah.
And so we have switched healthcare. I think we've switched it like 6 times in 8 years, and we just switched it again, hopefully for the last time since it's caught up a lot. But what happens is that every state has their own healthcare laws, and then there's a federal healthcare mandate as well. And so, for example, in the state of Oregon, for a long time, there was a required ratio that if you had less than 50 employees, you had to have at least 50% of them in the state of Oregon. And so for a while, we had 4 people who lived in Oregon, and then Rick moved and then I moved, and then suddenly we were out of that ratio, and that put healthcare in jeopardy for everyone else. And then it's actually finding a healthcare provider that will allow you to have someone in a different state. And so that whole thing is a big headache. Fortunately, it's a lot easier now than it was 4 years ago, but it is still taxing to find a plan that will accept you if you're less than a staff of 50 or better yet, even a 100, and actually give you real healthcare. Where it's not just this weird sort of coupon-based healthcare. So that's going to be a big struggle in figuring that out. And the second part is at hiring. The challenging thing about hiring is there's a tax component, but accountants, you know, if you have a good accountant, that's really easy. The thing that took us by surprise in hiring is how difficult it is to hire internationally if you want to stay by U.S. laws. So, for example, if we wanted to hire someone in the U.K. or Canada, for example, you really can't do it unless you hire them as a contractor. But if you hire them as a contractor, there's a whole set of laws where you basically have to prove that they're a contractor. And by the time you've prove that they're a contractor, chances are the work that they'll be doing for you won't resemble the work you actually need them to do. And so it creates this weird aspect, because if you hire someone as a contractor in Canada and their job and the practical work that they do is the exact same thing as someone in the United States, then the IRS can come in and say, why didn't you hire someone in the United States? Because you're not paying taxes on this Canadian guy and he's really an employee. And then you put yourself in jeopardy for HR laws because you have to prove that you couldn't find the talent in the United States, starting with your hometown and then the United States in general. And so if you're hiring, like in our case, if we're hiring a PHP developer and you say, well, I couldn't find one in the United States, that's really easy to disprove. And so then if you actually want to hire someone in Canada or the UK, then you have to actually establish a physical office there. And you have to pay taxes in those countries separate from the U.S. taxes. And so by the time you do that, if you're just trying to hire one off in Canada, one off in the U.K., one off in Ireland, one off in Norway, it makes it really, really difficult, especially since we're not project-based in the same way that a web agency might be. Those are the two biggest legal considerations that you really want to get professional help on.
Interesting, because don't you have support people in Europe?
We used to, but we don't anymore at this time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Though that was partly due to HR laws and partly because we really need full-time people. And so those things went together. Eventually, I would like to hire full-time support outside the United States. And this is a case where we can make a legitimate case and could make an argument because, again, that HR law, we could say, yeah, we want to cover someone in the European time zone. We need someone in Europe to actually do that. And so,
of course,
There are other complications, but at least that's a lot different than trying to hire for the development team or the creative team or things like that.
Okay. Well, I think that's all the time we have for today.
Les, before we end the podcast today, if any of our listeners wanted to follow up with you, how can they reach you online?
The best way to follow along is my Twitter account, which is Knight 777, like the medieval knight with a K. I haven't been that active online recently. On purpose, I've been taking a break from social media because we've got a lot of internal projects at Ellis Lab that I've been focusing my time on. But definitely follow the Twitter account because I'll be back on there probably in the next month and being a lot more active there. And of course, you're always welcome to email me. It's just leslie.camacho@ellislab.com. I read everything, and most of the time I can still respond to everything as well.
Excellent. Thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today, Les.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I always love coming on here, and you know, hopefully it won't be that long until we're on again.
Sounds good. Now we'd like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Engine Summit and Pixel and Tonic.
We would also like to thank our partners, Ellis Lab, Engine Hosting, and Devotee.
Also, thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about the podcast, make sure you follow us on Twitter at EE Podcast or visit our website, ee-podcast.com.
And don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll talk about dry techniques in EE with John Rogerson. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, ee-podcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for the Expression Engine Podcast. See you next time.
Cheers.